causing this outbreak. The World Health Organization has now deployed 50 experts and support staff to the affected areas, with another 17 on the way. Médecins Sans Frontières, which has called the outbreak unprecedented in terms of its geographic spread and complexity, is also currently working in the Guinean region of Guékédou, where the outbreak is believed to have started, in Conakry, Guinea's bustling capital, where the virus has now infected 20. The Ebola's presence in Conakry is particularly worrisome, considering its 11.4 million people and population density of 10,000 per square kilometer. When dealing with an infectious disease, they tend to transmit more easily when people are closer together, Fukuda said. The virus presence in a dense urban center also makes it difficult to trace people who have been exposed to the virus. Epidemiologists have now identified more than 600 people who may have come into contact with infected patients, according to Huguenet. He says, you can imagine that it's extremely challenging to follow them up because, in theory, what should be done is have a daily contact with them to figure out if they're still healthy. This is extremely difficult because the setting is difficult and the people are moving a lot. The situation has not yet warranted any travel advisories by the World Health Organization, according to Fukuda. Guinean health officials have said, however, that they are now screening travelers leaving from their capital city's airport. Ebola is very unlikely to spread internationally at this point, they write, according to Toronto researcher Dr. Kamran Khan, an infectious disease specialist at St. Michael's Hospital and the founder of BioDiaspora, a program that predicts the potential spread of outbreaks. We're dealing with less than 200 cases of infection amongst millions in the general population, he said. There's a fairly low probability that someone infected is actually going to get on a plane and go somewhere. That's the end of quote. Now, departing from this text, the reason that I brought this up is that, well, not that much is known about Ebola. And when I read that quote in The Star, it struck me as possibly a quote that is that was elicited in order to calm people looking at this issue. However, I don't see my role as calming people. I'm not into social control. I'm into news you're not supposed to know. And this outbreak of this variety of this hemorrhagic disease is pretty scary when I look at it. I look at it this way. We're talking about 600 people, not 200, as the Canadian doctor says in this quote. And we're talking about a 21-day incubation rate. Now, you may also have heard on the news that Ebola is difficult to spread and that it requires connection with the bodies. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. Let me describe. I read The Hot Zone 20 years ago. Maybe you did. I looked it up again this morning. Let me describe what I know about it. Generally speaking, you don't know that you have Ebola until your eyes turn red. And I don't mean bloodshot. I mean, they're completely red. When it gets to that point, what has happened is that the virus is amplified. It is so present in your body that it has taken over just every inch of your body, and it has millions of organisms or viruses in every cubic centimeter of you, and you're doomed when your eyes turn red. But that is not quite the terminal point. When it really begins trashing, it's a hemorrhagic disease, and it just kind of liquefies your body. I mean, it just turns you into a pudding. This description is hard to exaggerate. It really turns you into mush. And just before it completely turns you into mush and kills you, it makes you vomit. And if you're on a plane, or if you're in a bus with someone who has hurled this infectious matter, and here again, I'm talking about an amplified virus that is present in the millions in every drop, you also have become infected. I mean, just as soon as you see it and smell it, well, you've got a huge problem. And the kill rate is something like 90%. So let's put these things together. 600 known infected, last count. Large geographic spread, 21-day incubation rate, amplified hemorrhagic virus. I would say this definitely is a huge international story, or should be a huge international story, and that's why I started off with it, because I think this is one of those things that has a potential for being a huge worldwide problem. And the way they're screening people at the airport is if you have a high, well, if your eyes are blood red, they won't let you on. But if you have a fever, they won't let you on the airplane. But it has to be a pretty obvious fever. And for the first, you know, first days of those 21 days of infection, you're not going to show anything. So you can travel to wherever. And I think that this information should be looked at rather carefully worldwide. I think that no one should be leaving those areas on the airport at this time. Pretty harsh thing to say, but I think really that would be the responsible thing to do. Even though, of course, it's the important people, especially in an impoverished nation like Guinea or Liberia, it's the important people that come and go on the airport. Well, no one should be coming and going. Well, I suppose doctors can be coming. No one should be getting out on an airplane. There should be a quarantine of 21 days before you can set foot on one. That's my opinion. What's your opinion? The number to call, 503-231-8187. Now, one of the things that makes me so skeptical when I read these accounts in the press is the tendency worldwide of governments to try to control information like this and to make their first priority is controlling the population. And I don't mean controlling the population as in controlling the disease outbreak. I mean, they just like to control people. It seems to be human nature in governments, generally speaking. This is one reason why I'm an anarcho-socialist. People get this attitude that the most important thing is to control others. Let me give you some examples. In Japan right now, the death rate has gone up. And if you look at the official media, then you will hear that the death rate in the Fukushima area and in Tokyo has gone up because of stress. Have you ever heard of a stress outbreak knocking people dead? Me either. These people are dying of radiation. No doubt stress has a lot to do with it. But your body doesn't deal with stress as well. When you've got cesium trashing the cells in your heart so that your heart becomes weaker and weaker, and that's just one thing. Strontium gets into your bones, causes tumors. Other radioactive substances can just trash your mitochondria directly. Alpha emitters can do this. This is how an assassination was done in Europe at one point. So they're lying. Let me give you another example closer to home. In 2009, there was an outbreak of swine flu. And we were all taught to sneer about it. Remember the sneer? Have you got the sneer on your face already? We shouldn't have sneered because the swine flu hit the U.S. at a time when normally we would expect month to month one or two people would die. 10,000 people died. If 10,000 people died in a crashing skyscraper, that's all we'd talk about. But 10,000 people died across the continental U.S., and it was suppressed, really just kept out of the news. And I do mean it was censored. And now the World Health, Centers for Disease Control will admit the real numbers. But who's looking? Only people like me, who never trusted the government in the first place, will look and say, oh, we really did have tens of thousands, or rather 10,000 people die in the United States over that over those few months. And, you know, the people who died are dead. And but, you know, it kind of makes a difference when you know the truth. I suppose that it's natural people to blame themselves when their little baby died. One of the aspects of the swine flu in the U.S. During that outbreak was that elderly people are not the only ones who died of it. Babies died of it. Teenagers died of it rather suddenly. And it was actually because of that same phenomenon, I suspect, that amplification, very high numbers of pathogens, concentrated numbers. So that's two that I can think of, and I could go on. But I'm just saying that when I read this about Ebola, this is an extremely dangerous disease. And it is not true, as you may may hear that it is very difficult to transmit. If, as I was saying, you're on a bus and someone hurls this stuff, you're infected. Number call 503-231-8187, 503-231. With a corporate-owned press that is basically a mouthpiece for itself and for the government. We need to look more carefully at what information is out there. Now, one of the things that Linda Olson-Osterlin wanted to talk about is a National Day of Action Against Fusion Centers. And that's starting, let's see, this is the 10th. That's today at 11 a.m. Pacific. And thousands of people across the U.S. are going to coordinate protest teach-ins and creative actions as part of the National Day of Action Against Fusion Centers in 8 major cities and other locations to draw attention to spy centers in our midst. Although the stated objective of fusion centers is to collect, analyze, and share specific counterintelligence data with local law enforcement and government agencies to protect our communities, in practice, the opposite is happening. This is about secret police. Returning to the text, on March 11th, 2014, the New York Times revealed that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court approved the sharing of raw data from the National Security Agency with the National Counterterrorism Center, the agency that coordinates information sharing and oversees programs like fusion centers. Through the fusion centers, local police, municipal and state governments, and the private contractors can also access the data the NSA has on anyone they choose to target. And departing again from the text, when you heard a few years ago, for example, that the Oregonian or TriMet or various local businesses were part of the InfraGuard program, that meant that they are in on the loop on this sort of spy information about you. And U.S. citizens have been trained to think of the FBI as that friendly bunch of G-men, those G-men that go after, you know, the Dillons among us and bring them to ground. Well, they're first and foremost, I would say, about controlling the population on a basic political level. They are secret police. And when you hear that the FBI has analyzed something in their amazing FBI laboratories, just remember that they've been caught faking evidence more than once. But returning to the text of the announcement, since 2003, the Department of Homeland Security has spent billions in public dollars to support state and local fusion centers. This is not about power. This is about bringing together cops and spooks, a majority of which, they write, has gone unaccounted for. Majority of that, those billions. In October 2012, a report concluding a two-year investigation by the U.S. Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation revealed a massive misappropriation of federal funds, lack of oversight by the DHS, and violations of American Civil Liberties and Privacy Act protections. Despite Senate findings, fusion centers continue to operate in most U.S. states, draining our resources and endangering our liberty. Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Code Pink, Oakland Privacy Working Group, Restore the Fourth, Stop LAPD Spying, and several other activist groups are jointly organizing diverse actions in Boston, Charlotte, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, Oakland, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., demanding their respective states to first, shut down the fusion centers, second, stop funding fusion centers, and third, release all suspicious activity reports and other secret files. So that's happening today, and you may have recalled what difficulty the Portland mayoralty and city council has had trying to back off the fusion centers while they're back, and we do have a fusion center. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. It's doom and gloom day today because now I want to talk about the methane apocalypse. And Dar Jamal, thankfully, has written an article. And when Dar Jamal writes an article on a big topic, it's a treat because he does the work. And that his last name is spelled J-A-M-A-I-L. And he wrote an article in Truth Out, which is worth looking up. I want to share some of that with you and see what you think about it. Invite your calls, 503-231-8187. It starts off, Antarctic, largely devoid of ice. Giant methane outbursts causing tsunamis in the North Atlantic and global sea levels rising by several meters by mid-century sound like the stuff of science fiction, but to a growing number of scientists studying anthropogenic climate disruption, or ACD climate change, these dramatic predictions are very real possibilities in our not-so-distant future thanks to the vanishing Arctic sea cap, Arctic ice cap, which is continuing its rapid decrease in both volume and area. Arctic sea ice researchers are predicting that sea ice will no longer last through summers in the next couple of years, and even U.S. Navy researchers have predicted an ice-free Arctic by 2016. Whichever year the phenomenon begins, it will be the first time humans have existed on Earth without a year-round sea ice in the Arctic. And scientists warn that this is when abrupt climate change passes the point of no return. Now, departing from this article, I've been following this sort of thing for at least a decade, and I do remember a decade ago talking about the clathrate burst and the methane apocalypse. And I've been there's more that Dar Jamal writes about this, and he talks about how huge these methane vents are getting. Well, my estimation is it ain't going to be mid-century that we start seeing some of these horrific results, and my Swami-like prediction for 2014 is come summer, we're going to see some horrific storms, but I'll give you some more information on why I think that in a minute. More from Dar Jamal's article in Truthout. In the first year that this happens, the open Arctic Ocean state will only last for a few weeks or a month or so. And that's according to Paul Beckwith, a climatology and meteorology professor at the University of Ottawa, Canada. He said that to Truthout. Within a year or so, the open water duration of no sea ice will last for several months, and within a decade or so, the positive feedbacks is the word that you need to remember, will likely clear out the Arctic Ocean basin for most of the year. As the planet transitions through this abrupt climate change, there will be wrenching turmoil and conflict for human civilizations, end quote. Beckwith, an engineer and physicist who is also researching abrupt climate change in both the present day and in the paleo records of the deep past, warns that losing the Arctic sea ice will create a state that will represent a very different planet, with a much higher global average temperature, as much as 5 to 6 degrees centigrade warmer within a few decades, in which snow and ice in the northern hemisphere becomes very rare or even vanishes year-round, end quote. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's most authoritative voice on climate science, whose reports influence policy and planning decisions of national governments across the world, has just released its latest report. The IPCC has been accused by much of the scientific community of having a starkly conservative bias. In other words, they're dragging their feet on these predictions. Scientific American has said of the IPCC, quote, across two decades and thousands of pages of reports, the world's most authoritative voice on climate change has consistently understated the rate and intensity of climate change and the danger these impacts represent, end quote. Now, departing from the text, this is the same IPCC that the conservative commentators on the television and in the radio have been claiming are bug-eyed alarmists. Scientific American says, you know, why are they dragging their feet? Why are they being so overcautious? Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. And Harry's on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Yes, I'd like to your comment about Fukushima.
Yes.
Yeah, one of the reasons why they're probably the death rate is probably higher because there is a gag order on the doctors.
That's true as well. They're really trying to, and that was the point I was trying to make, is that the governments are very, very interested in controlling the population first, and thus controlling information.
But the idea that a doctor can't tell you, hey, you have radiation poisoning, that's horrible.
It is kind of a shocking thing. I mean, makes me glad I'm not Japanese, but.
Well, thank you very much.
I mean, just for that, well, I suppose there are other qualities which might make me glad to be Japanese. I will leave it at that, but that's a horrific thing that's going on, and that the contamination certainly has spread far and wide and includes Tokyo. I haven't forgotten the high radiation counts from the dark matter aggregating algae blooms there in Tokyo. You still there? All right. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I was talking about the IPCC report, talking about how careful it is. But Dar Jamal writes, however, the recently released IPCC report is raising eyebrows. Even this conservative body is predicting dire threats for people and other species in the near future, and these risks may very well mean abrupt or drastic changes that could lead to unstoppable and irreversible climate shifts, like the melting of both the Arctic ice cap and Greenland's glacial ice. According to the IPCC report, the polar bear is not alone in being under threat. The polar bear is us. That's the quote. The polar bear is us. That's according to Patricia Romero-Lancao of the federally financed National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, referring to the first species to be listed as threatened by the global warming due to melting sea ice. Beckwith, who believes that the planet is already in the early stages of abrupt anthropomorphic climate, abrupt ACD, climate disruption, I forget what the D stands for, anyway, offered grave predictions of what we might expect from losing the Arctic ice. As the planet transitions through this abrupt climate change, there will be wrenching turmoil and conflict for human civilizations, he explained, as the extreme weather events ramp up. This will result in a frenzy of human activity to attempt to adapt and mitigate. Essentially, the tipping point in the Arctic will inevitably result in a tipping point in human response to the problem, end quote. And, once again, speaking for myself, this is why I'm presenting this. Wouldn't it be nice if we as a society could recognize that what I believe is the fact that we have already passed that tipping point. That trigger has been pulled. And when I say trigger, I mean that's a good metaphor for what's happening. Once the methane started releasing itself, the trigger had been pulled, and this has been going on for a few years. I'll have more details on methane bursts in a minute, but they are extremely alarming. And the fact that the Earth has gotten to that point means that, well, here's how it works. The Earth got warm enough to release the methane that is in the permafrost and in the clathrates under the ocean. Now that that is being released, methane, which is 20 times at least more effective at trapping heat from the sun, is becoming a major component of the atmosphere. This will make more methane. This will cause more methane to be released. We're talking gigatons of methane, and that will make things change so fast and will make things so hot so rapidly that it'll just be a situation on this planet will be unrecognizable. So I say that we have already passed the point of no return. It was nice to think that by bicycling and recycling, we could keep from getting to this point. And I congratulate everyone who gave a sincere effort to that. Thank you very much. You were a good example. It's too late. And now you will find that various schemes are popping up for trying to stop the mass extinction of humans. That's how bad it is. And the people who are denying it are just laughable. They're getting more marginalized. I guess you hear the climate deniers more on the UFO shows late at night on AM radio. They don't have a scientific leg to stand on, frankly. I mean, it's just a matter of looking at the charts of temperatures. It's impossible to deny that global warming is happening. It's certainly impossible to deny that these methane bursts are happening. Number to call with your comments, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Now, what I have recommended for years now is that there be an international effort to ban nighttime contrail-forming jet flights or airplane flights. The reason being that after September 11th, 2001, there was a shutdown of air traffic, and it turned out that without contrails in the air, it became obvious what the contrails do. When the contrails were gone, the surface temperature in the day heated up. I mean, it's just a fact. It's not a little bit. It's a degree or so across the continental United States. And at night, with no contrails, the temperatures dropped a couple of degrees. And what was happening is that during the day, these contrails, which have a high albedo, they have ice crystals, reflect a fair amount of heat back into space. And at night, they reflect that same heat back into the planet. Take away half of that. Take away contrails at night, and the planet will radiate its heat into space at night, and global warming will be reversed. That ain't asking for much, is it? I mean, it's either that, or there are some other schemes, which sound as hokey as they are, I think, blasting sulfur particles into the atmosphere, that sort of thing, trying to mimic volcanic eruptions in that way. I say, let's do it the easy way. Let's make the airline industry save the Earth. They'll be so proud. Your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Want to go on further with the details, which will explain to you why you are living in the middle of the methane apocalypse. But Natano is on the air.
Hi, Teresa. Hi. It's good to hear some realism once in a while. Very few people want to admit that we are kind of over the falls. And what you always hear is, well, if we act now, we can save it. But I talked to Roger Revelle in 1992 and asked him if he thought, you know, there's a chance that we could get control of the media and you know, get the word out and, you know, stop the process by fixing carbon, because that's the only way that we could have done it was fix carbon. And we need, I mean, if people want to get serious, that's the only solution to stopping this whole thing, besides, you know, not using the sky as a sewer and just keep dumping this stuff.
Yeah, we know one technique which won't work, and that is doing nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a huge effort going on right now with net zero buildings, and, you know, more and more companies are trying to do the net zero thing, which is really great, but the real key, if someone wants to get really serious, is that, you know, hemp is the most photosynthetically efficient plant on the planet, next other than what grows in the sea. I think seaweed grows a little faster, but hemp is like 2.5% efficient, where wood and, you know, normal plants are about 1 to 1.5% efficient. And,
so another way to say that is sequestration of carbon by growing hemp and other plants.
Right, because that's, you know, we've got to fix the carbon that's, you know, trapping the heat. And if, you know, if we could control the media, cable is the only, you know, realistic platform or relevant media as far as, you know, people like me are concerned, because it's not influenced by commercials. If you have commercials in your news, you're going to have conservative fossil fuel views, because that's who, you know, controls the 98% of the media. But
in my opinion, it's this coming disaster. This is the reason that, let's see, is it Homeland Security and FEMA, I think, have bought millions upon millions of bullets. Their way of,
yeah,
that's their way of admitting that the methane apocalypse is coming. Thanks very much for your call. And I want to go into a little bit more details, trying to nail down this case that we are in the midst of something that is absolutely unstoppable unless something very extreme happens. Thanks for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Arctic sea ice is critical to the Earth's system because of its role in controlling the planet's temperature, climate, and currents, as according to Nissen. Writing, this is in Darjamal's article in Truth Out. Nissen said, warm currents from the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans flow to the Arctic and are cooled. Extra warming of these currents has resulted in a retreat of the sea ice with a loss of albedo, that's solar reflection. Same thing I was talking about with contrails, albedo, solar reflection, as the sea ice is replaced by open water. The open water absorbs the heat, which accumulates and helps to melt the sea ice the following year in a vicious cycle of warming and melting, end quote. Nissen explained that when the sea ice no longer forms in the summer, there will already have been a great reduction in albedo. Arctic warming, which is occurring at 1 degree centigrade per decade, will accelerate at a rate of several degrees centigrade per decade from then on. There is historical precedent for this, as Arctic warming of 7 degrees in one decade occurred at the end of the Younger Dryas, an abrupt climate change event accompanied by many meters of sea level rise. The Younger Dryas is one of the more commonly used examples of abrupt climate change of cold climatic conditions. It has happened in the past, and drought that occurred between approximately 12,800 and 11,500 years ago. While there are many theories, the event is thought to have been caused by the collapse of the North American ice sheets. Arctic ice serves as a planetary air conditioner. We've never had humans on a planet without Arctic ice, which suggests that the planet is too warm for larger-bodied mammals, that's you, in the absence of the planetary air conditioner. Guy McPherson, professor emeritus of evolutionary biology, natural resources and ecology at the University of Arizona, and a climate change expert of 25 years, explained to Truth Out why the Arctic is so critically important to the planetary weather system. And quoting McPherson, Arctic ice serves as a planetary air conditioner. We've never had humans on a planet without Arctic ice, which suggests that the planet is too warm for large-bodied mammals in the absence of the planetary air conditioner, with an Arctic that is ice-free in the summers. McPherson predicts rapid, dramatic changes. Earth will heat up quickly, he says. Consider, for example, a relatively simple example from the realm of physics. Slightly more than 79 calories are required to convert 1 gram of ice at 0 degrees centigrade to 1 milliliter of water at 0 degrees centigrade. But once the ice is converted to water, adding the same amount of energy, that's freezing, by the way, or just above freezing, zero centigrade, adding the same amount of energy increases the temperature of that water to slightly more than 79 degrees centigrade. He then goes on to imagine that on the scale of the Arctic Ocean. Without any ice, he says, in the Arctic to absorb energy, the energy will be absorbed by the dark ocean water. Even a tiny bit of ice provides a tremendous buffer to runaway heating by the ocean, hence the planet. Heat moves from the warm equator to the cold poles of the Earth via the atmosphere circulation patterns and ocean currents, but due to human emissions of greenhouse gases, the planet system is warming. In the Arctic, this means that the warming is causing the sea ice volume and spring terrestrial snow cover to decline extremely quickly, thus exposing the darker underlying surfaces of ocean water and permafrost on land. These darker surfaces absorb more solar energy, and thus there is an amplification of warming of the Arctic at rates to 5 to 8 times faster than the overall warming average. That's quoting Beckwith. He says, this decreases the temperature difference between the Arctic and the equator, and thus decreases the heat moving from the equator northward, resulting in a slowing of the westward movement of the high-speed winds making up the jet stream. The jet stream becomes wavier, leads to an increase in the frequency, intensity, duration, and spatial extent, location, and variation, end quote. And if you're wondering what he means by that, that's why you have these huge winter storms. Ironic, isn't it? Global warming has let cold weather splash all over this area and over the United States. It's global warming because it's thermodynamics.